In 1939, a WPA project called America Eats sent writers all over America to document our nation's traditional foods. Work on it was abandoned when we entered World War II, and the raw material was never published. Mark Kalansky discovered the project's archive in the Library of Congress while he was researching another book, and now by combining selections from the original material with his own commentary, he's turned the archive into The Food of a Younger Land, which offers a glimpse into eating in the 1930s and early 40s. It's published by Riverhead. You may remember Mark Kalansky's earlier visits to the show, many of them involving books about food like Cod, Salt, and The Big Oyster. I'm very pleased to welcome him back today. Hello.
Pleasure to be here.
Who came up with the idea of America Eats?
A woman named Catherine Kellogg, who was a remarkable woman for her generation, who had quit a high-paying job when the Federal Writers Project was created because she thought this was just such an exciting idea. And she came up with the idea of the guidebooks.
Mm-hmm. So she had done that before she did this thing.
Yeah. And, you know, there were no guidebooks to America except the 1909 Bedeckers that had been done by a Brit. And she thought it was time for America. This was a feeling in the Depression in general that, you know, it was time for Americans to take a look at America. So she did all these guidebooks, all 48 states, most major cities. They were tremendously successful. Major literary critics wrote rave reviews. They were bestsellers. Some of them are still in print. They're very readable. And after they'd done a guidebook to almost everywhere imaginable, they were getting kind of down to small towns, she came up with this idea of doing something about food, about what Americans eat, eating traditions, what kinds of gatherings. She wanted, like the guidebooks, to be very socially oriented.
But wasn't there a certain amount of controversy around the Federal Writers Project? Some people felt that this was money not well spent.
Yeah, well, listen to this, President Obama. What Roosevelt did was he got a bill through Congress that just allotted a budget to create projects. And then the WPA and the Federal Writers Project and the Federal Arts Project and all of these famous New Deal things were never voted on by Congress. They were by executive order. And Congress didn't like the Federal Writers Project at all.
Because it couldn't control it.
Yeah, and because conservative Republicans thought that writers were dubious characters that taxpayers shouldn't be giving money to. And my favorite incident was when they decided to do a translation of the Song of Songs from the Bible, which, of course, was ancient Hebrew, into modern Yiddish. And a congressman, obviously not Jewish, looked and saw it was the same alphabet. And he said, "What a scam. They've translated it into the same language."
So what was her plan? What was the idea here? That they would go into small towns and find out what people cooked? Or
the country was divided into five regions. And each region was going to have an established writer write an essay. Nelson Algren did the Midwest. People were just told to send in whatever they could find. They said particularly look for things of social significance, look for food conflicts like arguments about clam chowder in New England or barbecue in the Carolinas or mint julep in the South. Just whatever you can, send it in, and then this writer for each region would extrapolate this stuff and write these essays so that most of the stuff in my book was never intended to see the light of day.
This is the raw material.
Right, and it's unedited.
Even though it's, in some cases, written by pretty famous people.
In some cases, and in some cases written by people who weren't writers at all. And, you know, they wrote short stories and poems and descriptions and recipes, and some just sent in information. You know, really, whatever they wanted. People who had worked on the slave narratives went back and got African-American traditions. And you know, most of this stuff was just going to be extrapolated, and we weren't going to see it. I feel proud that, you know, I have given to American literature the poem that was in obscurity, Nebraskans Eat Their Wieners.
Yes. Well, I suspect that the book that you've come up with is very different from the book that would have been produced 70 years ago.
Completely different.
And partly because this is really a snapshot of a moment. Were the writers aware that they were documenting something that could change in a very short time?
No, I don't think they were. And you know, I say that looking through these boxes was like opening a time capsule, but it's really different than a time capsule, because in a time capsule, you put things in with the idea that people later will look at it. They didn't expect anybody to look at it. There's probably things I read that, you know, I was the first person to ever read. You know, they just, these things were just, you know, sent in a hurry. And after Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941, and December 8th and December 9th, Catherine Kellogg sent out all these frantic letters saying, whatever you have, send it in now, because she knew it was ending. So people just sent in whatever they had. And shortly after, she was fired, and her boss was fired, and she just took whatever she had and gave it to the Library of Congress.
And then it sat there moldering?
Yeah, and, you know, because it's completely unedited, we have a more honest view of 1940 America. Than, for example, a lot of the Southern manuscripts are extremely racist. And you read through them and you say, oh, yeah, this is pre-Civil Rights South. This is what it was like. Well, the people running the Federal Writers Projects were very socially conscious people, and they would have edited out all that stuff.
On the other hand, there were some African-American writers who also were hired. But considering how the racial attitudes that you're describing, how were they treated?
Well, it depends where they went.
Zora Neale Hurston, for example, who was a Republican, we should point out.
Zora Neale Hurston was probably the most qualified person in the Federal Writers Project. Not only had she published three books, including a very respected novel, but she was a for real anthropologist with a degree from Columbia when Columbia was the place to study anthropology. Margaret Mead was her classmate. And the Federal Writers Project, she went to see Henry Alsberg, the director, a fellow Columbia graduate, and he was thrilled to get her. You know, we've got somebody who really knows what they're doing. And he sent her to Florida, where she was from, to be a supervisor. And all of these letters proceeded, you know, saying Miss Hurston is coming down from the north. She's learned to put on airs and smoke cigarettes in front of white people and things like that. And she got down there.
How dare she?
Yeah, and they gave her the lowest rung job.
Even though she was the most qualified, she was brought in at the lower rung.
On the other hand, Richard Wright in the North was nurtured, was recognized as somebody of talent who was working on important things, and they encouraged him. Ralph Ellison was encouraged, so it kind of depended where you were.
Some pretty good writers there.
Yeah.
Nelson Algren, too. That's pretty good. Who else?
Saul Bellow, John Cheever. The head of the Federal Writers Project in San Francisco was Kenneth Rexroth, the original poet. And I think nothing expresses better how unusual this whole Federal Writers Project was, and the idea that a beat poet would be the director of a government program.
My guess is Mark Kalansky, whose latest book is called The Food of a Younger Land. It is published by Riverhead Books. Well, you discovered this thing, I said earlier, while you were researching another book.
Yeah, well,
how did you come upon it?
Nelson Algren kept a copy of his essay. There is a copy in the files in Library of Congress. By the way, not everything is in there, and I did find a few things in other places. New York wasn't in there, and I found that by accident when I was researching my Oyster book here in the Municipal Archives in your old neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. In the building that we used to be in that's falling apart.
Right. When he died, it was found in his papers, and University of Iowa published this essay, which was over 100 pages long. And they called it America Eats, and they explained that he had written this for a WPA project on food that never happened. And I thought, God, this is fantastic. I'd love to see what else was written for this. And because it was government, I called the Library of Congress, and I said, do you have a WPA project called America Eats? And you know, the guy disappeared for a couple of minutes and then came back to the phone and said, yeah, we have boxes and boxes of it.
Come on down.
Yeah.
Well, what did you see your role here as basically as an editor, as somebody who is going to cull through all of this stuff and come up with little gems?
Yeah, I wrote an introduction and I annotated. I tried to find out who they're, I mean, obviously I knew who Nelson Algren was and who Dora Welty and a few of those people, but, you know, I tried to find out who these other people were, which was quite interesting and a lot of fun. Some of them turned out to be known writers in their region who have been forgotten, and playwrights and children book authors and newspaper people. So where I could find that out, I give that information, and I sometimes give background on the manuscripts, because a lot of them don't come with much background. And what I wanted to do was give readers the experience that I had of, you know, suddenly opening a door and finding yourself in 1940 America, which was a younger land, a very different place.
And we're talking about the end of the Depression. Is the Depression reflected in what you found?
Very much so. There are a lot of recipes for making things with nothing. There's a recipe called Depression Cake, which has no eggs and no butter. And she says in the it was 4th of July, the chickens weren't laying eggs, the cow had run away, she had to come up with a cake. You know, she took some flour, some baking soda, some bacon drippings, some sugar, and just, you know, every
bacon
spice.
Bacon drippings.
Yeah, and every spice she had in the house. And it sounds horrible, right? And she said it sort of bubbled up like lava, and she put it in the oven, and it came out, and oh my gosh, it looks just like a cake. Mm. And everybody tried it, and they liked it, and a chef in Boston last week named J.J. Gonson made this cake for me. And I wasn't going to try it. It sounds horrible. She made it for me, and it was wonderful. It was really good.
So people can try some of these recipes.
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't intended it as a cookbook, but my experience, the things I've tried, have all been really quite good and a different kind of food than we eat today.
Well, one of the things in the book is a glossary of New York soda luncheonette slang and jargon, and some of it is pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
I spent a little time when I was in my late teens working as a waiter.
Did you speak this language?
A few of the phrases.
Did you call pork
but
chops?
Pork chops I never called Hebrew enemies.
No.
And
I
don't know anybody.
Really like is, you know, Jell-O desserts were a nervous pudding.
Yeah. In some cases, usually the jargon was to shorten the order,
but
in some
of them
cases
are
these are longer.
Yeah.
The other reason, of course, is to keep people out of the business if you didn't know what these
right.
things meant. But a lot of them are very funny. Pennsylvania, we discover, is a leading producer of cultivated mushrooms. Is it still?
It actually still is, but at the time it was the sole producer of cultivated mushrooms. It's still an important producer.
So people weren't eating wild mushrooms as much as they do today?
No, they weren't. I suppose people out in very rural areas were, but you know, finding wild mushrooms in a New York supermarket. Well, I mean, we can remember when that started happening.
There are several pieces about chowder. Were there regional rivalries over the right way to do some of these things?
Oh, yeah, especially. I'm from New England, so that one resonates with me. You know, I mean, I'm sorry, but
no, I prefer New England to Manhattan chowder.
Well, you know, Manhattan chowder actually was from New England, but it was, you know, in New England, if you want to call something completely wrong, you call it New York. you know, I mean, Long Island clam chowder, I'm sorry, it's not acceptable. On the other hand, there's a nice Long Island rabbit recipe. Long Island was always known for its rabbits.
One of the restaurants written about in the book is still open today, the Grand Central Oyster Bar.
Right.
And you've written about oysters, of course. Are any of the writers still alive?
The only one I know of who's still around is Stetson Kennedy in Florida, who's well into his 90s. I talked to him. I've been working on this for a long time, so I don't know. I guess it was 3 or 4 years ago when I talked to him. But
he had to be in his early 20s when he did this.
Yeah. And he worked with Zora Neale Hurston and, you know, talked to me about how badly treated she was.
What about Eudora Welty? You have a short piece of hers on Mississippi food. Was she already well known at the time?
No, she had. I believe she had done one short story which had been well received. But the Depression hit her pretty hard, and she had to stop her education, which I believe was at Columbia. And she, you know, she was a struggling young writer.
There's a Frances Densmore, who also did field recordings of Native American music. She compiled Sioux and Chippewa food.
Yeah, and she was an important anthropologist of her day on Indian traditions. And some of that Indian food is really interesting to read about.
Do you think much of it is produced today?
I don't know. I mean, one thing that I found, I've been traveling around the country doing call-in radio and giving talks and stuff, and people have been coming up to me, and it's quite surprising the stuff that still is around today. I was just in Atlanta, and while they don't make Coca-Cola parties anymore, I met two people who remember in their youth going to Coca-Cola parties. A lot of this stuff is still around. It's the difference is that in 1940, this was the food of America. Today, you have to be a detective to find it.
Well, I think that we've come back to some of this stuff because food was local at the time, and then after the war, it stopped being local, right. And now there's the new movement to make it local again.
Right, but the difference is that it wasn't a movement. It was necessity. It was all they had. And while it's great now, I very much like this movement of going back to local, but we're not going to do all of it. We're not going to go back to canning food in September and October to get through the winter, which is what you had to do to live locally.
And I don't know whether I'm ever going to try to do a Kentucky burgoo.
I don't know. There's a number of things there.
Filets. Filet gumbos, I know that from Hank Williams. I don't know if I know it from having been to New Orleans.
Oh, well, filet is still very much an ingredient in New Orleans. A lot of these things are so, you know, the persimmon pudding in Indiana. If you go to Indiana, I went to college in Indiana, and I was recently out there, and I was recently out there talking persimmons. And, you know, most people in Indianapolis had never heard of it. But if they happened to come from one of three counties in southern Indiana, they knew it very well.
Mm-hmm. This is really regional.
Yeah.
Just one more thing. You mentioned that poem. Do you remember any of it by heart? Nebraskans eat the wieners?
No,
And is it true? Do you think Nebraskans eat more wieners than people in other parts of the country?
I don't know. There's an interesting thing there from Iowa about popcorn, and Iowa still remains the largest popcorn producer in America. But I don't remember.
Do you think it's a good poem?
I think it's an awful poem. And I think that probably the person who wrote it never imagined that 70 years later it would be published and probably wouldn't have been pleased about it.
Well, we don't have enough time to have you read
it
now.
There was a lot of goofing around going on in the Federal Writers Project offices.
Well, it's good that they were having fun. Right. Mark Kalansky will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store in Tribeca. That's at 97 Warren Street at Greenwich Street. And this book is a lot of fun, and I'm so pleased that you came by to talk about it. It's called The Food of a Younger Land, and it's published by Riverhead Books. And, Mark, I look forward to the next one. You always come through with something interesting.
Thank you, Leonard. Nice talking to you.